Hello and good evening, machinistas here. Welcome to the Perpetual Motion Machine. I'm your mad scientist, Wally. And with me in the studios, our whole rolling wave of fellow mad scientists. They are wild about fires. They currently research wildfires in the Silvus Lab at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. So joining me here is Franz Schug, who is a postdoc studying how wildfire affects the wildland-urban interface. Natalia Arogova, who studies how wildfires affect the grasslands of a steppe ecosystem in Kazakhstan. And my science collective co-host, Connor Steffens, who studies how wildfire is changing circumboreal forests. So, lab mates, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Thank you. We're going to do a little kind of quick extended, you know, the Empire State elevator pitch for your research. So kind of get us in and out of why the fire is important, what you're doing to study it, and, you know, what's cool about it. So let's start with Franz.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for the invitation. It's very good to be here.
Yeah, good to see you. Good to meet you, really.
So my name is Franz Schug. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the Silvus Lab, University of Wisconsin-Madison. I have a background in geography, actually, so my degrees are in geography. And I'm currently specializing in remote sensing, which is means analyzing satellite imagery. And the current interest of my work is to look at how, when, and where people are potentially at risk from natural hazards. Oh. And that does include wildfires. Hmm. So what most of my work is I use satellite photographs to map and quantify features of the built environment. So a very simple example would be we compare historic satellite imagery with contemporary satellite imagery and find out, for example, where settlements have been growing. Mm-hmm. That is then what we use to ask how did this growth, for example, affect that risk that people are at from wildfires when cities expand, mm-hmm. knowing that also in many areas also wildfires expand due to several reasons, one of them being climate change.
So overlap between kind of risk and settlement.
Yeah, exactly. So there's what we call hazard, which would be the wildfire, and the settlement.
So how do you, is this to inform policy or insurance or just maybe just people that want to build a safe home?
That is actually a very good question. Because funny enough that I've been at a conference 2 years ago and then the one single person that approached me after my talk was from an insurance company. And I was like, oh, okay, that's nice to meet you. It's commonly not the people that we target, but it's certainly people who use our products. Mm-hmm. I haven't worked a lot with managers, for example, because the data I produce is usually data that just hasn't been there before. So it's experimenting with data, producing data sets, assessing quality of new data sets. Also, second aspect is that my research is rather broad scale. So we recently published a global map of the areas where settlements overlap with wildland areas. Mm. That is obviously where this risk is most likely to happen. Mm-hmm. For the United States, for example, there's about 100 million people living in these overlap areas of settlements and wildlands. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that they're all, you know, exposed to wildfire hazard. Many of them live in eastern states, but many live in western states, and this is where we have seen population growth in the last 20, 30 years. It's also where we have seen increased wildfire frequency and severity.
If you live in the woods, it's its own blessing, but it's also,
well, it's very
you live
nice
in the woods, right?
It's a very nice place to live in.
Yeah, the treehouse lifestyle. I've been there I lived in a tree for a while. It was a redwood in Berkeley.
But, were you a tree sitter?
No.
Oh, I got very excited for a second.
I was just living at a co-op that had a treehouse. Oh, yeah. Anyways, so awesome. Thank you so much. Let's move on to Natalia. And if you could tell us your research, please.
Hi, everybody. It's very nice to meet you here. And thank you for inviting me. I'm from Russia, and in Russia, I worked as an ecologist, studied mainly grasslands, grassland ecology. Mm-hmm. Currently, I am doing my research here at UV Medicine. In Russia, also, I traveled a lot. I had a lot of field work across all the Russia. And additionally, I participated in a civil firefighter team, and I worked as a firefighter in natural reserves more than 10 years. So I studied fires not only theoretically, but I got a lot of practical experience.
But you are alive.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a lot of running around, huh?
Yes. And I study fire history in post-Soviet countries, and it is very interesting to compare fire regime changes in post-Soviet countries and here in the U.S. Because post-Soviet countries, it's a kind of natural experiment. During Soviet time, there was no active fire suppression, but there was no practice, fire usage practices. Mm. It was just not common. Mm-hmm. There was no agricultural fires, there was no prescribed fires. But after the crash of the Soviet Union, there is still no active fire suppression, but there is no control over people. So actually they could do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
And it is...
What would they do?
They burn a lot.
Yeah, okay. And I'm sure, I mean, I've lived in the woods. You have to stay warm. Cold,
especially in Russia.
Build furniture. You know?
No, it's very interesting to see difference between let's say Russia and Baltic countries that currently in European Union. And in Russia we have a lot of fires, and in Baltic countries there is no fires at all. And it's hardly to explain by fuel accumulation or by climate change, whatever. It's just about human behavior,
right?
And as in the U.S. And in actually globally, people are the main source of fires in wild.
Mm-hmm.
Though we think wildfires it's somewhere in nature and it's natural processes, but it's not true.
To some extent, but yeah, because humans, and what do we even mean by wild, right? I mean, I think you say rewilding, and then we talk about conservation and wild spaces in America. So the idea of what is wild and what is fire, I think, is fascinating to discuss as well. Because if our Native Americans here were causing fire, and that's been a way of life, and what, ravens can move, birds can move fire?
Firehawk.
Right.
In Australia.
It's amazing. So, awesome. Well, thank you. All right. Let's move on to Connor. So, Connor, tell us about your interaction with wildfire.
So hello, everybody. I'm Connor. I'm actually one of the mad scientists on PNM here, but this time I'm on the other side of the desk, which feels a little different. My background's in forestry, field forestry. I went from that area into geography and then now remote sensing, like Natalia and Franz here. Most of my experience is really in temperate forests, so the forests of the western United States and those fire regimes. But here, I actually work on boreal forests, which are the forests in the cold regions of the world, basically.
You said circumboreal, so could you? What does that mean?
So,
I know what it means.
Yeah, but so geographically speaking, the circumboreal forests are the forests of Canada, Alaska, Siberia, Russia. Generally speaking, a boreal forest is really defined by two things: vegetation cover and temperature. So it's a forested landscape, but also the average temperature of these forests is below freezing at least 6 months a year.
Mm.
So it's a very unique environment. It really contributes to a lot of carbon accumulation because you have these ecosystems that are dropping biomass. And then because of low temperatures, that biomass is not broken down as effectively. Mm-hmm. So you have these large accumulations of organic carbon in the soils and so forth. What I look at here is basically I'm curious about if fire, its distribution and abundance is actually changing over the amount of time that we can look back at it. So for such a large region, we use satellites to track fires just because going out and, mapping every single one of them is basically impossible. for that kind of extent.
And dangerous.
And dangerous. Although some people thought, think it's fun. I think it's, it could be pretty fun. Talk to Natalia.
Yeah, right.
So I look at how, how it's changing in its abundance, but now I also look at if this is related to climate in any way, if warming and drying is affecting burning, and if in turn those climate trends are also affecting how landscapes recover from fires in these areas. So that's my general area of research.
So recover, so it's a long-term game as far as what's going to grow next or how that the whole cycle works, right?
Yeah, that really depends on the forested ecosystem you're talking about. A lot of boreal forests are adapted, so they are expecting like what we would consider catastrophic fires, so fires that come through and kill 90% of trees. But their regeneration cycle is adapted to this. So when that happens, their seed stock is preserved in things like serotonous cones and stuff like that, cones that open after fire. And then they just have this massive dump of seed after fire, a huge flush of seedling regeneration, and the system recycle restarts. How often that happens can really depend on where you are. It can be 50 years, it can be 500 years. It just depends. So what I'm curious about is whether or not changing warming and drying conditions, like, you know, heat stress and drought, is actually affecting that seedling recovery cycle.
And that's going to be kind of a mosaic over the landscape for where you see fires happen and they don't happen. And in America, we've done, as well as sounds like in Russia, fire suppression has not been done in different places and wild spaces, but in the West it has been pretty much carried out. So we're not having these big fires anymore, but then we see that the fuel load is not being taken care of and we have these large fires. So we're kind of in this extreme situation.
We're sitting on a mountain of gasoline with like a box of matches on fire. Basically.
Yes. I've walked around those woods in the West Coast and you see all that fuel on the ground. And that's going to pose risk for people's livelihoods and their homes, right? As well as opportunity for that next generation to come, as long as it actually can regenerate successfully from that. So there's got to be some management implications in there, I'd imagine. So what if, I guess I'm curious, you all talked about sensing. How do you sense this? What do the satellites look like? Like, what are you guys collecting for data from there?
It's very different data depending on what your question is. So for the broad scale applications, we usually use data that is freely accessible. It's basically public data. It's what we call medium resolution imagery, like pixel resolutions of 10 to 30 meters per pixel. And these are NASA satellites. There's the Landsat program that acquires data since the 1970s. Though we commonly go back to the 1980s because of data restrictions. There's European Space Agency satellites, Sentinel program, who do the same thing at high resolution, but not just for the last 10 years or so. And then there's various particular there's coarse resolution satellites, which I don't use. Connor can talk more about that. I have recently used satellite imagery from the so-called Keyhole programs, a program of military reconnaissance satellites from the United States from the 1950s to, it's an ongoing program, but they started to declassify data in the mid-90s. So
sweet.
Yeah, so we
it's
now
pretty
have,
amazing stuff.
Recently did a study where we mapped building footprints, building outlines for the city of Madison for 1972. And it's amazing, very high resolution. You can basically see the cars on the street in 1972. It's panchromatic data, which means it has one band of information. There's no red, green, blue information. It's just grayscale, basically.
Interesting.
But still very impressive what you can see on these images.
Okay, well, we're going to go to a quick song here. And everybody at home, you get out your panchromatic goggle blasters and look at the maps across the scope to fire. We'll be back in a minute after a quick break.
Yeah, when I was only 17, I could hear the angels whispering. So I drove into the woods and wandered aimlessly about, until I heard my mother shouting through the fog. It turned out to be the howling of a dog, or a wolf to be exact. The sound sent shivers down my back, but I was drawn into the pack, and before long they allowed me to join in and sing their song. So from the cliffs and higher still, yeah, we would gladly get our fill, howling endlessly and shrilly at the dawn. And I lost the taste for judging right from wrong, for my flesh had turned to fur, yeah, and my thoughts they surely were turned to instinct and obedience to God. You can wear your fur like a river on fire, but you better be sure if you're making God a liar. I'm a rattlesnake, babe, I'm like fuel on fire. So if you're gonna get made, don't be afraid of what you've learned. On the day that I turned 23, I was curled up underneath a dogwood tree, when suddenly a girl, her skin the color of a pearl, she wandered aimlessly, but she didn't seem to see. She was listening for the angels just like me. So I stood and looked about, I brushed the leaves off of my snout, and then I heard my mother shouting through the trees. You should have seen that girl go shaky at the knees. So I took her by the arm, we settled down upon a farm, and raised our children up as gently as you please. And now my fur has turned to skin, and I've been quickly ushered in to a world that I confess I do not know. But I still dream of running careless through the snow, and through the howling winds that blow, across the ancient distant flow, that fill our bodies up like water till we know. And you can wear your fur like a river on fire, but you better be sure if you're making God a liar. I'm a rattlesnake, babe, I'm like fuel on a fire. So if you're gonna get made, don't be afraid of what you've learned.
All right, welcome back to the Perpetual Notion Machine. I am your mad scientist, Wally, here with my fellow mad scientists, Natalia, Connor, and Franz. And they are wildfire scientists. They are fire wild about science and wildfires and wildfires, you know, bonfires even. So we've had a nice little chat during our music break, and we've got some interesting things to dive in. I'm sure you do as well. So if you figure out how to message us, you can do that.
We'll
look at it later. Okay. So first, I think we're talking about, you know, we're in our own backyard, and I think it's important to talk about the human interface, which is what Franz does. So when we're talking about fire interface and human urban interface, like what, how many miles, how many feet, how many acres, or I guess kilometers for the science crowd?
So wild and urban interface is a term that we use quite a bit for our research, and there's other, you know, there's other terminology. People call it different things. There's rural urban interface. I think we talked about that earlier. It raises so many questions. What is wildland? What is wild? and so on. It's we follow a definition that has been shaped in the early 2000s by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and that has a defines certain distances, and that is two categories. One is about 500 meters, you know, from your house, basically. Mm-hmm. So we look at average vegetation coverage in that radius, and the other describes. So that describes the intermix, like where you know, vegetation and settlements mix, houses actually mix. Mm-hmm. And then that's what we call interface. And that has a distance of 2.5 kilometers, 2.4 kilometers. That distance is motivated by how far embers fly.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, this is very debated, because the wildland urban interface is not only something we look at for fire, but also for other like biodiversity impacts and so on. And then these scientists say, this is an arbitrary distance.
Right. And if you say that and then you have to convert that to like feet, it's like half a mile to like 2.5 miles, you know, or so, right? Because kilometers, whatnot. So, yeah, because it's going to based on like wind conditions and I'm sure dryness and all kinds of factors for how the risk actually spreads, right?
Yeah. Though this is not considered in this wild urban interface definition. And this is a problem, because when you use these, you know, strict thresholds, so and so many houses per acre that then counts as intermix and so on, that means you can map all kinds of wild and urban interface. Mm-hmm. People say, yeah, but this is not an area at risk. And so, yeah, we know, but, you know, that's what the definition says.
Mm-hmm.
So mapping these areas can only be the first step to then, you know, look at your local area or region and then define what these data actually mean for you and for your application and for your management.
And to read Franz's shirt, to respect the topography, because we all know that makes a big difference if you actually work with fires, a valley versus a plain versus a prairie. So talking about your own backyard, we talked a little bit about the NIMBY principle, mm-hmm. So not in my backyard. And as an ecologist and a hiker, I have these sacred spaces that I'm so glad I haven't burned, but probably should. So, Connor, what can you say about the West and fire suppression and climate change and how people, the perception and the control are interfacing with that?
Yeah, so this is a very complicated topic, and it spans many decades of perception of like the human interaction with nature and what that means and what wildness actually means. I don't even know how to start this, honestly. It's so complicated. Basically, fire was very common in the West, especially in the dry, temperate forests of the West, for thousands of years, up until colonization. And once it happened, there was kind of a European mindset of we have to protect our resources, and people viewed fire as a damaging, a damaging force to these forests. And I suppose that if you just walked into a burn area and you weren't aware of the ecology and how things regenerate and have adapted to the system over thousands of years, that might seem so, right? You say, oh, things get burned, some trees die, right? But you can definitely go way too far with this, because if you start removing disturbance, which is fire in this case, from systems that require it or have adapted to it, you throw the whole thing out of balance. So we've removed fires for about 100 years in the West. I have the most experience with California, but it's true for the entire West Coast. And because of that, we've had forest densification of something like 600 or 700% over that time period. Mm. So if you think about the number of trees per acre, roughly 600-700% increase. So these systems are typically adapted to very frequent, very minor fires that kill maybe one or two large trees, a lot of little trees, but the superstructure of the forest is basically intact because there's not very much fuel because fires have been removing it.
And there's thresholds to you. There's like a hot fire versus like a cold fire, I guess.
Yeah, there's two terms. There's fire intensity and fire severity. Mm-hmm. Intensity is like the raw heat of a fire. And that doesn't necessarily mean that a fire is killing trees, because trees can be adapted. You can think of redwoods are pretty adapted to hot fires. But severity is what's the percentage of your trees that have died. And that's what we've seen a lot of increase in over the last, you know, 40 years or so in the West. There was a lag time between when fires were being put out and fuel accumulation happened. So basically, there was a number of decades, maybe 50 years, where it was very easy to put out fires because there wasn't very much fuel. But it accumulated to such a point where it's basically impossible on very, very bad condition days. And because of that, they explode into, you know, million-acre fires, which is so far beyond the natural range of variation in California, it's basically not comprehensible.
Mm-hmm. And just catastrophic as well. So that's fast. I think about this all the time. Mm-hmm. And people blame other policymakers about mm-hmm. fires, and it's this long, it's a 100-year thing. We did this big cutover, and now we have kind of distanced ourselves from how fire in our backyard is treated. So I would love to get some perspective from Italia, from your home country, and you live on a place where fire is kind of unregulated. So let us know about how Siberia works for these kind of things and what that forest is like and what people are doing out there.
Well, in contrast with the US, Siberian fires are not adapted, forests are not adapted to fires. Fires not common because there is no much lighting,
and very very moist too.
And they are much more moist. And really, old growth forest that existed hundreds of years,
800,000 years. Yeah,
yeah. They so moist that it's almost impossible to start forest fire there. Even if a lightning stroke happened, it would kill one or two trees, nothing more. And when people started to use this forest and cut them down and then grow new forest, that forest have different structure and they cannot keep so much water. It affects all water cycle across large scale, and such forest became more dry, more flammable. People come, start fires, and this is a circle of forest destruction. And currently we have a lot of things to do to protect existing forest against fire. And if we let forest growth itself, after several hundred years, forest get their natural structure again, there would be no fires. But at some point, people cannot wait so long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the boundaries are there, and they're going to have the interface. So that's amazing. I thank you so much for the insight. I've learned some stuff myself about what we mean by inner urban areas, what we mean by regeneration, and a bit about the cycle of how fires work all around the world. So it's unfortunately almost time for our show to end. I've been joined in the studio with Franz, Natalia, and Connor of the Silvis Fire Lab, and I'd like to thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having us. It's been fun.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
So, hey, have a good fire out there. Remember, fire is natural. So maybe start a fire about the world around you. It's all about change, right? So I've been your host, Wally, and you've been listening to the Perpetual Notion Machine, our collective-based science news show, 9 FM. Have a good night.